I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, an important and rousing conversation with Hans von Sponeck, a longtime German diplomat whose accomplishments include serving as UN Assistant Secretary General and UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Iraq. The following conversation was initially intended to have a much narrower focus, highlighting von Sponeck's experiences inside the United Nations as they relate it to sanctions against Iraq. Von Sponeck, like Dennis Halliday before him, resigned from his position as United Nations Humanitarian Coordinator for Iraq in protest of the UN's sanctions policy on that country. Parallax Views, of course, has previously covered the subject of sanctions and their deleterious effects with UN Special Rapporteur Professor Alina Dohan and journalist Brian McGlinchey. In this conversation, Hans von Sponeck provides his own personal testimony about the deleterious effects that sanctions had on Iraq. Ultimately, however, our conversation ended up expanding beyond the narrow focus of sanctions into a really, in my view, important discussion about civil society, global policy, and cooperation, in which Hans von Sponeck provides an insider's account, an insider's perspective, if you will, of the United Nations, while calling for international dialogue between not just governments, but people around the world, as not just a pie-in-the-sky dream, but rather a necessity for our collective future. All that and more on this fascinating edition of Parallax Views with former UN insider Hans von Sponeck. Welcome to Parallax Views, Hans von Sponeck. How are you doing today? All the way out in Germany, right?
That's right, in southern Germany.
So if you could, for my listeners, could you explain how you became involved with the UN?
For a German, not an easy story, because I joined the United Nations in 1968 when Germany wasn't a member of the United Nations. So German nationals were not on the most favorite nation list at all at that time. It was a struggle because many reasons. One main reason for me was that I was supposed to be filtered by the German government, and I didn't want to do that. I wanted to be selected because I was I, and not because some political channel sanctioned me to be appointed by the United Nations. That delayed things, but ultimately, after trying over a couple of years, it, by coincidence more than deliberate act, I got an opportunity to join the United Nations Development Program. And that was the beginning of a 32-year career with the UN.
So I feel it's important to talk about the role of the UN in the world. How should we understand that role? What are some of the pros and cons of the UN as an institution? Maybe just discuss that a little for the sake of my audience.
Well, you see, the problem starts when one talks about the UN. What animal is this? Who is the UN? What is the UN? And as a former insider, I can tell you right away that there are fundamentally, there are two United Nations. There is the political United Nations, well known, the Security Council, the General Assembly, the International Court of Justice. These are the three columns on which the institution stands. But very often, there is no link made in the public mind that there is this other UN, the development-oriented United Nations, the humanitarian organization, the organization that comes in when there's a catastrophe, wherever in the world, whether an earthquake in Pakistan or a tsunami in the Caribbean, whatever it is, the UN is there. The operational UN is so distinct from the political United Nations. And over time, for many, many years, certainly in the first 20 years of my UN life, the distinction was such that the political UN, the Security Council, the General Assembly, they were plenty busy in New York. They left the operational UN fairly much alone. We could do what we wanted to do in these many developing countries in which the UN was active. That has changed. There is now a linkage, and I welcome this to some extent, that there is a linkage between the political UN and the operational UN, the world of the UNICEFs, of the UNESCOs, of the World Health Organization, of the UN Development Program, of the UN Fund for Population Activities, all these many units that make up that operational United Nations. And this, the isolation in which we lived and worked for so long, that isolation now is breaking down. There's more interaction, and the political UN, Security Council, and to some extent the General Assembly are now becoming increasingly aware of the body of knowledge, the competence, the experience that this operation UN has acquired over the year, And I believe it's not unfair to conclude that this, of course, is very important to the operation of United Nations, because it creates an atmosphere, an environment in which we are much more relaxed in operating, knowing that there is the policy-making body, the Security Council, that is the policy-maker, and the General Assembly, that they are standing when it comes to development issues, when it comes to human development issues. There's much more focus now on people. Do we have to forget, or should we forget, that there's something called the United Nations Charter that begins with the words, "we the peoples." And we the peoples, whether we work in the UN or outside as normal citizens, is irrelevant. The fact is that it is a people's organization and should be seen as such. And I think we are on the way now of creating this new partnership between the political side of the UN and the operational side of the UN.
So just adding to that, it sounds like you're very hopeful for the future of the United Nations. And, you know, I hope that that assessment is correct, because I think the idea of the UN is very invaluable. I think we need more global cooperation and coordination in the increasingly complex world we live in.
But let me ask you, can we really afford not to have a multilateral body that deals with the lives of people, that deals with the translation of this huge body of international law that has been created over the last 75 years in order to make life better. This is not an emotional high-flying optimism. I think it is so necessary that the lives of the people, civil society, must be in the forefront of concern of an international body. Whether you call that the UN or any other name, it is necessary. Now more than ever before, since we have now all the tools, these great tools of communication, these tools can be misused, and they are being misused. There's a lot, as you know better than I, there's a lot of disinformation floating around about anything we can say, including about the United Nations. We are incompetent, we are overpaid, we go to cocktail parties but don't do our work properly. Somebody cynically once answered how many people work in the United Nations, and the answer was about half. Now, that is not a fair assessment of what we are, and we, of course, with very limited, and that people who may listen to this interview may want to understand, with very, very inadequate resources. The amount of money the United Nations has is completely different in reality than that which is often portrayed in the media. To give you an example, if you're interested, the budget of the United Nations for 2021 is $3.1 billion. Okay. Now you take look at the headquarters of the UN is in New York. You look at the budget of Columbia University, or you look at the budget of the police department in New York that looks after the security of 3,000-4,000 UN people. You will be surprised. Their budgets are higher than what the Secretary General has per year, $3.1 billion for 193 UN member countries. Not a big deal. That's number one, I want to say. Number two, particularly in the United States, there is that impression created by people who don't mean well as far as the UN is concerned, which says the United Nations is receiving what amounts to a sacrifice by the American taxpayer. Now, that is an incredibly serious allegation, because there is no sacrifice. The amount of money which the American government generously but has to pay, these are assessed annual contributions, is about $600 million a year. This amount, which is so badly needed by the UN, comes in very late. The US government usually pays instead of the 1st of January of each year, it pays in October or November of each year. That's already one problem. The other problem is that in the committee meetings where financing is decided, the US position is usually very conservative. Now, somebody who knows a little bit more than the average person knows about the UN will discover that the US contribution on paper, this is obligatory, this is not voluntary, the obligatory payment amounts to 22% of the UN budget. Now, that's a heck of a lot. When you have 193 member countries, one country paying 22%, that's a lot. And the public, the immediate reaction of the public is, that's outrageous. That's much too much. How can? Well, let me tell you, there is a formula for assessing what countries should pay. And according to that formula, if that formula would be applied to the US government part of that budget, the US government would have to pay more. The US government is the only country out of the entire 193 community of nations that is not following that rule in order not to make the contribution by the US government too big. I personally, as an individual, always felt over the years quite uncomfortable with this 22%, because it makes us vulnerable. If a government, some of your governments have been very forthcoming, have been sympathetic, were more than others multilateral oriented, so there was no problem. But the moment there is a problem, need I to stress how it went between 2016 and 2021. We had a big problem with the Trump administration, and they were withholding funds, they delayed payments, they gave us a lot of difficulties. Now, if the amount is less, then that plays into the hands of greater freedom in decision-making. And so I think 22% is too high, but whatever it is at the moment, that has to be paid. And it is honored by the US authorities, often, however, with inordinate delays. Now, one more point on financing to show you what about this accusation that sacrifices are involved here. I couldn't hear this. Year after year, I would hear by particularly such political operators like John Bolton, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. for a while, and later on the Trump national security chief, he would say, he would use that word sacrifice. So I looked a little bit deeper at the contributions, and what did I find? I am very fond of a tiny country in the Himalayas called Bhutan. It has less than 1 million people. And I have been there, I have friends there from my UN days. And I looked at my own country, Germany, and I looked at the US. And I compared the contribution, now that's important, compared the contribution on a per capita basis. What does an individual in the US pay compared to the UN budget, compared to what a German pays or a Bhutanese? And you know what I found? The party, the country, the people of Bhutan pay more on a personal basis than Germany and the US. So sacrifice, if anyone makes a sacrifice, then it is Bhutan compared to the other two, you see. So there is a lot of misunderstanding. Some of it is innocent. A lot of it is less innocent. People try to politicize facts about the United Nations. And, you know, when I lived my almost 2 years in Baghdad in the years of sanctions against Iraq, it was a daily challenge to try and correct misinformation, disinformation about the United Nations. But to come back to what you said earlier about the UN, the old adage, if we didn't have a UN, we would have to create a UN. We can, in this global village in which we are living, we must have one mayor, one secretary general. We must have one parliamentary type set up in order to get our act together. 7.6 billion people in the world need to have an institution that brings some order at all levels, political, environmental. Look, the climate accord in Paris, for example. It needed the United Nations to come together and to debate. And in my mind, the key words that should be in our mind when we talk international politics in the 21st century must be convergence and compromise. If we in the West, we Europeans and you North Americans, if we do not understand that the world is not, today's world is not the world of 1945. The world is not the Cold War days in the confrontation with Eastern Europe. It's something else now. And if we don't understand that we cannot expect to play the first flute or to be the conductor of the global orchestra, then everyone will lose out. We have to get our act together. That's the challenge of the moment. And the chances are, every day there are chances to show that we take that seriously. And you know as well as I do, we are at the moment in probably the most polarized circumstance in which the world has found itself since this horrible Second World War. And in such a situation, you need bridge builders. You need people who can cross from one side to the other and begin to understand what the other side is thinking about, what the other side needs, and come to some compromise. UN doesn't need more exceptionalism. UN does not need more unilateralism. And the US authorities must realize that leadership must be earned. It must not be acquired by military power or by political lobbying. It must be earned. And I belong to those here in Europe who keep with great enthusiasm, but insistence also, to argue that we would like to see a strong United States involvement. We would like to see US leadership, but US leadership in the context of dialogue and of looking, having level playing fields on the basis of which global policy is being developed.
I want to move on to the issue of sanctions, but one last thing I wanted to ask you with regards to the bigger picture of the United Nations. I think that one thing that people here in the United States have trouble understanding is what developing nations really want. I think sometimes, you know, there's this right-wing reactionary element in my country that seems to paint developing nations as out to get America or anti-America. And I don't think that's the case. And I think you've actually spoken to the fact that that's not really the case.
It's not the case. But, you know, there's the big T is missing. There's a big T. The T stands for trust. And there's a big difference also between political positions taken by governments in developing countries and by civil societies in these countries. What does a poor farmer in northern Pakistan or in Latin America, high in the Andes, or on the Pacific Island in Fiji. What do they want? What does a normal citizen want? He wants peace. He wants to have the trust in the goodwill of his or her government and the trust in the ability of the international community, for example, the United Nations, to deliver all these great words, the good rhetoric that we hear every year coming out of New York, coming out of the United Nations, translated into action. There is no, this is so painful to repeat this, but there is no shortage of funds. There's only one thing, and that is there is a shortage of willingness to share what we have. We are so incredibly lucky. You in the US, despite your great internal poverty issues, you are lucky. We are lucky in Europe. But that luck needs to be shared a bit. You know, the resources need to be honestly apportioned. You have followed what's happening now in the pandemic in discussion, how the vaccines are oversupplied in some of our countries, and there is practically no supply in a good number of developing nations. Now, this kind of cleavage, this kind of gap that exists is the biggest enemy of good international relations and a shift in the geopolitical climate from confrontation to cooperation. This is so clear. And that is, I think, where we have to understand that allegiance between a government in the developing world and in with our governments in the Western world is too often dented by very brutal self-interests, by corruption. Corruption is a major reason for the slowness in which the South, the Southern Hemisphere, the developing world, is overcoming their all these constraints that they face. So there's a difference between the relationship that the United States or Europe has with the developing governments or the governments in the developing world and the people that live there. The people that live there don't trust their governments in most cases. I generalize, it's maybe not quite correct, but the point is that huge amounts of goodwill, of resources, of efforts, sincere efforts. You are living in a generous nation. I was a student in America for 10 semesters, for 5 years I studied in America. I know how generous Americans can be, but I also know how brutal American governments can be when dealing with the outside world. And I think there, that's where there's a challenge. So it is rebuilding trust. It is sharing the wealth that exists in the world that is available to cover every household with a meal, with a proper roof, with health services. That must be in the forefront if we want a world that is moving towards less rather than more confrontation.
So that brings us around to the question of sanctions. And I think there's been a lot of talk about sanctions lately, especially due to the pandemic. We've seen the effects of sanctions on Iran during the pandemic. You were involved as the UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Iraq, taking over for, I believe, Dennis Halliday, and you dealt with this issue of sanctions. Could you talk a little bit to that and the specifics of the sanctions against Iraq?
Well, let me say this. The first thing that one has to realize is that sanctions in themselves are very dangerous. Sanctions on their own, without the wider context, can only mean that the people, again, the civil society, are the main victims. And that's exactly what happened in Iraq. You had very powerful American, but I would go beyond that, Western interests to try and make sure that the controversy that was brewing in the Middle East, most clearly in Iraq at the time when I was there, that this should end up in a win situation for Western interests. Okay, so sanctions were imposed, and the word is not coined by me, but it was a word that was often used in Washington and in London. Too bad, people, collateral damage. It's what a euphemism for something that is so horrific. What one could see in the households where I went in Baghdad or elsewhere in Iraq, I could see what sanctions were doing. And I could also realize, but late, maybe I should have realized it much earlier, we could have done anything we possibly could have to implement our mandate, which was a humanitarian mandate, but it would never have led to the lifting of sanctions until Saddam Hussein was gone. So there was a political decision already. And you remember 1998, the Iraq Liberation Act was signed by the US Congress and by Bill Clinton. And it was very clear even before that the politics were such that nothing would change with regard to sanctions until that regime was gone. And therefore, in the Security Council, in the UN, a lot of the decisions that were taken there under heavy pressure from Washington and from London were dishonest. They pretended to help the Iraqi people, while in fact, they did not. There was no such thing, and there is today no such thing. If I move for a second from Iraq to Iran, this idea of smart sanctions, of focused sanctions, sounds good, is totally dishonest. If Mr. Kofi Annan was the one who said this comprehensive economic sanction that is imposed on Iraq is a blunt instrument that we must not use anymore. So the clever politicians came along and said, okay, we'll do it better in Iran. We will have focused sanctions for Iran. What does that mean? If you focus your sanction package on financing, then you are focusing sanctions on the same comprehensive setup in Iran as we had it in Baghdad. You know, so smart sanctions are those sanctions that are part of a package of approaches, of policies in dealing with a country that is under sanctions. That means it has to be much broader than just economics. And you must never, in my view, exclude diplomacy as a tool that brings solutions. So the idea that you could impose sanctions on Iraq and then hope that the government of Iraq under Saddam Hussein would disappear was an illusion, was foolish. But let me just assume that this was innocent. What was not innocent was all the side efforts that were made by the British, by the Americans, in trying to force the government of Saddam Hussein out of its location. And any tool was good enough. Disinformation, lying, secret actions, all kinds of methods were used in order to make it uncomfortable for the government in Baghdad. But ultimately, the discomfort was for 23 million Iraqis, including the Kurds in the north. The Kurds in the north were slightly better off because there was that vision in the minds of Western politicians of a split, giving the Kurds independence ultimately, and the Shias in the south possibly also independence. It all didn't work out. What Paul Bremer, the administrator in the post-sanction period in Iraq, we call them the viceroy, what he should have known and what is the great criticism one can have about him was that he had no clue whatsoever about the history of Iraq and the ethnic picture. The fact that Baghdad, for example, was the world's largest Kurdish town, I don't think he ever knew that. So there is, in my days in Baghdad, under sanctions, there was no question about, are you Shia? Are you Christian? Are you Sunni? Didn't happen. Nobody was interested. There was this ethnic carpet was woven in a way that the threads went from one side of the ethnic picture to the other. There was a lot of integration. And what we have done, particularly, I must say, sorry, it sounds so anti-American. I am not anti-American at all. I have an American wife. I know America very well. I appreciate America, but that does not forbidden me to be critical. And what happened because of ignorance and because of political presumptuousness is to create the kind of Iraq that we have post-sanction now in that part of the world.
If I could, when you were in Iraq, if I have listeners that may be a bit younger, I have a lot of listeners that are just going off to university and just learning about these issues like sanctions, foreign policy. What were the impacts that you saw in Iraq that made you refer to it as a true human tragedy? Just for younger listeners that may not know all the details, what did you see there?
What do you mean? In terms of?
In terms of the damaging impacts that sanctions had.
Well, you know, the impact was, here was a nation that in mid-1995, 1996 had received, no, a bit earlier, a prize from UNESCO for being one of the more advanced university setups in the Middle East. You had a medical picture that was much better than in the neighboring countries. You had a well-to-do, well-endowed society led by a dictator. Yes, one has to acknowledge that. But there was a lot of money. The Middle Eastern countries benefited from scholarships. Egyptians, Syrians, Jordanians, Palestinians came to Baghdad to study. All that was ended under sanctions. And the sanctions were, you may not believe this, but the sanctions were so immensely comprehensive that a young family, which I got to know in Baghdad, could not get musical notes from abroad because they were subject to sanctions. A man who had money in an account in London, an Iraqi, who badly needed an operation, was not allowed to draw on the money that he would need to have an operation in the neighboring country, in Amman, the capital of Jordan, because of sanctions. To make it even worse and painful for me as a former UN official, every country, yours, mine, and Iraq, can be a recipient of all the documentation that is being produced by the United Nations. Iraq was deprived of that. Iraq was not allowed to get the comprehensive package of important, interesting, useful documentation to come into the country. So wherever you looked, life became cruelly, cruelly inadequate. And then the effect of 1991, nobody should forget what we left, what American military left behind, the depleted uranium factor that played a very big role in the health picture of southern Iraq. You should have gone with me to the child and mother hospital in Basra in southern Iraq and seen what depleted uranium was doing to children. You should have gone into hospitals in Baghdad where they didn't have enough bandages to treat patients that came in. And this makes it for me so important, the generosity of these people was there. I was invited to share a humble meal with people in Baghdad or in Basra or in Najaf or wherever it was in Iraq. These are generous people that were really brought down to the most subhuman level than you could imagine. Their university system broke. It didn't function. How could it? Can you do research when you're not allowed to get the research paper into your country, when your internet isn't working? Nothing is working. When you travel under normal circumstances before the war of 91, it would take you an hour to go to a location. Now it would take you 3-4 hours. Every aspect of life was upside down.
Even food.
Food was one thing, but I must be fair here. As far as UN sanctions were concerned, food was the one area which worked relatively well. The World Food Program of the United Nations imported every month 440,000 tons of food to feed 23 million people. That worked. And yet, there was disinformation sown by the US State Department. They brought out in September 1999 a booklet called Saddam Hussein's Iraq, which painted a totally ridiculous, false picture about the conditions and the behavior of the government of Iraq. I do not, I must hurry to add this, support a dictator. Saddam Hussein had done many very bad things, but what was described in that booklet was simply false. And we in the UN in Baghdad, the UN officials, my colleagues in the World Health Organization, in the Food and Agriculture Organization, in the World Food, we sat together and we started laughing about that booklet because it painted such a false picture, you know. And so sanctions were implemented closely aligned to disarmament. And people I remember an Australian diplomat in New York saying in a meeting where I spoke about Iraq, when I said the linkage between sanctions and disarmament created a horrific human catastrophe. He said, what you're saying is preposterous. That was the word he used. There can only be a linkage. There must be a linkage between sanctions against the people and disarmament. And Mr. Negroponte, the American ambassador, the future ambassador in Baghdad also, but in a congressional hearing, he said, yeah, well, that's collateral damage. We have no choice. Our first priority is to make sure that Iraq gets rid of its weapons of mass destruction. Ignored were the voices such as the one Scott Ritter, chief arms inspector in America, from the Marines who worked in Baghdad, who said in 1996 already, Iraq is qualitatively, very important, qualitatively disarmed and sanctions should be lifted. Well, nobody listened to that because Saddam Hussein was still in place. So it is a composure, it's a mixture, a cocktail of political interests, power that plays into this, and people who have needs like any need anywhere. People have certain basic needs that were not met in Iraq, and it was a complete disaster that was perpetuated and even worsened, if one can say that, after the 2003 war of 19th of March 2003, as you know, when the factor, the new factor was that didn't exist before. In Iraq, and usually in a dictatorship, security is not so much of a problem, but security became a huge problem at the beginning or after the war was over in April of 2003. So the Iraqis were punished yet again at the end of 2000, at the end of sanctions. Another chapter of misery has begun, and you know how the picture is today.
You mentioned the issue of information and disinformation earlier. I wanted to give you a chance to respond to a lot of people. Whenever you bring up the sanctions in Iraq, they'll now talk about this London School of Economics study claiming that the Hussein regime had doctored statistics, that there was no rise in child mortality. How do you respond to that as someone who was there?
Well, not only was I there, but I was participating in that survey as an outsider. But it was UNICEF that took the lead and conducted that child mortality survey that the Lancet and the LSE people are talking about. And as so many other things, scientific evidence was politicized, okay? UNICEF took full responsibility for that study. They had their own people, they had their own specialists, they were Arab-speaking, they knew what the story was, and if you go into the records, you will see that UNICEF very clearly said, we were not lobbied into results that did not reflect what we ourselves found. Now, let me condition that a little bit by saying, in New York, I was often challenged by certain groups, not by Kofi Annan, not by the Secretary General, when I reported about conditions in Iraq, including this study, that I should be more sensitive to the fact that there was a political element in whatever was being done in Iraq to identify human misery. Well, all I can say is my answer was clear but not accepted. My answer was, in a country or that is in a state in which Iraq is, you cannot compare that situation to a situation in Vermont or in Georgia or California or Germany, where a scientist can go about his or her research and come up with hardcore facts. It's not possible. In Iraq, that wasn't possible. But Iraq, the intentions were to come as close to the true picture as possible. And I also get uncomfortable when people come with figures. Was it 500,000 children that died? I my answer is, maybe I'm here a little bit escapist, but my answer is, even if one child dies because of sanctions, because of circumstances, it's one child too many. So I don't care, is it 500,000? All I know that many died. And UNICEF identified, came out with statistics. These statistics were accepted by some, rejected by others. I know, without now going into details, because that would be uncomfortable, I want to report to you that I attended with eight other persons a meeting at Columbia University to discuss this kind of issue. And one of these people represented the interests of a government that wanted to accuse the Iraqis of all kinds of wrongdoing. And we told him, look, you are putting a political label here on something which should be a scientific discussion. He walked out of the meeting. So in other words, what I'm trying to say is it was very difficult to convince all parties concerned that the work of the United Nations was maybe not adequate enough. I grant that, but it was innocent and it was honest. That makes that big, coming back to the beginning of our conversation, that makes it so obvious what a civil service, an international civil service, the UN civil service, what problems this group of people have in comparison to the political pressures that are coming our way all the time. You know, and this mortality survey you are raising is a very good example. It's a very dramatic example. But one can disarm the people who, for their own political interests, one can disarm them by saying, look, if you say it isn't 10, but it's 9, maybe you're right. But 9 is also the wrong figure. It shouldn't have happened.
So the other issue with sanctions, and I think you'll provide a very good response to this, a lot of people will say, well, sanctions is a better foreign policy option than war. How do you respond to this mentality? And is there another option beyond sanctions that would be you know, just better for all involved.
Obviously, how can one disagree that war is the worst option, that sanctions are, but as I said, sanctions on their own are another kind of war. Sanctions must be cushioned into a wider strategy of trying to solve a problem. And you cannot avoid them to discuss across the table. Let there be a round table where you look at each other and there's no bossman, there's no leader. There's only a group that tries to get together around that round table to come to some kind of solution. That wasn't wanted. The dialogue was not wanted. Dennis Halliday, my friend and colleague, we speak regularly with each other, and I were asked by the French at the time to come to New York to the Security Council after we had resigned from our post. He earlier than I, as you know. The British and the Americans refused with the feeble argument that we had no experience with sanctions. We had experience with the most complex set of sanctions that had ever been introduced. Why do I say that? Because, you know, ultimately it comes down to the fact that disinformation can be attacked by the kind of work that the UN was doing in the context of health or in the context of agriculture. There's many examples where the work of the UN could have been a breakthrough, but that wasn't wanted because ultimately the British and American governments were fearful of truth. They didn't want to have people in a dialogue situation that would come up with non-ideological information. You know, so that was the tragedy, that we were not, that the UN was blocked and the Secretary General was too good a human being. Kofi Annan was soft. He didn't like conflicts. That the whole team he had in us in Baghdad, in New York, it was a different circumstance, because in New York he was facing in his own office environment people who represented a very hardcore anti-multilateral, anti-Iraq position. So there were clashes within his office on the 30th floor of the UN building in New York, between him and, for example, his deputy, a former deputy minister of defense of Canada. It was absolutely counterproductive to what the mandate was. The remit of the UN in Baghdad was to ease the impact of sanctions.
In closing, are you hopeful about where the conversation may be heading with regards to sanctions? Like I said earlier, I think a lot more people, especially now in the U.S., are questioning these sanctions, seeing the effects it is having on certain countries during the pandemic. What do you make of that? And I also wanted to get your take on how maybe we can secure a better future for our children and our grandchildren in this really increasingly complex and, you know, conflict-ridden world that doesn't need to be conflict-ridden. I think we can be more cooperative. I know that's a two-part question, but
That's a good point you made. I related to that already earlier. But as I see the development with sanctions as an instrument, it's shifting. You don't have, with the exception of Iran, you do not have the kind of comprehensive nature of sanctions. Today, sanctions have become more personalized. People get on lists and then they are blocked. The Russians are blocking Americans. The Americans are blocking Russians. The Chinese are blocking Americans. The Americans are blocking Chinese. So it's that kind of more symbolic kind of approach in showing the other side that one disagrees with their policies. So the maybe Mr. Kofi Annan, after all, has won the battle when he said, it's a blunt instrument. And what I should have said earlier, I forgot, is that it wasn't a lack of knowledge what sanctions were doing in a country like Iraq. There was even a statement, you can read it, it's in May 1995, five permanent members of the UN, including the US, the UK, Russia, China, and France, got together and identified what had to be done in order to protect a population in a country under sanctions. They knew very well what needed to be done, but they didn't follow that. So there was this discrepancy again between rhetoric here and action here. And to come to your second point, if I repeat what I said earlier, if you do not understand the importance of communication, of dialogue, number one, if you don't understand that in the third decade of the 21st century, you cannot exclude civil society anymore from discussing global policy issues, then you will get nowhere.
I just wanted to add to that, and I guess this is where I was going with that second question of securing a better future. I think there's a problem, at least here in America, where a lot of citizens view things as a zero-sum game. So, there are citizens that think, if we have to compromise with another country, what am I going to lose? What am I going to lose out on? And I don't think everything is a zero-sum game. I think we can work together to all sort of benefit.
There's no question about that. And particularly now, when we are such an integrated world, when we have the tools to communicate, when for the first time a Bolivian can talk to a Thai, when a Kenyan can talk to a Swede, we can talk, we can together communicate. We must not and should not leave the dialogue among nations to governments alone. The people must come into that. Civil society has a role. The United Nations is opening its doors. Thank God, after many decades, now it's much easier for non-governmental organizations to participate in the UN business, the General Assembly, even the Security Council, certainly the Economic and Social Council of the UN. There are opportunities. We must now try to strengthen these, and we must insist. That's maybe the new boy or girl on the block is civil society, and we must give them a chance to be heard. And maybe then we get into another kind of circumstance where we create, isn't that what it's all about? That ultimately we create a win-win situation for 193 member countries around the world, rather than continuing cleavages, confrontation. We had no time to discuss a meeting that I attended, that I was asked to attend on the 16th of April with the Security Council. And this is exactly the kind of point that I made. Dialogue is the order of the moment. And dialogue not just between governments, but dialogue involving more holistically people, civil society, leaders from non-governmental organization world. And then maybe we have a chance. I'm an optimist. I think there is at least a chance, which is great. Let's work towards it. And people like you and your efforts to bring knowledge into the public are immensely valuable, and we should all be grateful that you exist.
Well, I want to thank you, Hans von Sponeck, for coming on Parallax Views, and I share your optimism for the future, and I think it's not just optimism. I think it's just necessary that we make these changes in our world. Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Hans von Sponeck. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Brian, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.